Today's Teisho is on case one in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, Joshu's Mu. A monk asked Joshu, "Does a dog have Buddha nature?" Joshu answered, "Mu." Mumon's comment: in order to master Zen, you must pass the barrier of the founders. To attain this subtle realization, you must completely cut off the way of thinking. If you do not pass the barrier and do not cut off the way of thinking, then you will be like a ghost clinging to the bushes and weeds. Now, I want to ask you, what is the barrier of the founders? Why, it is this single word, Mu. That is the front gate to Zen. Therefore, it is called the Mumonkan of Zen. If you pass through it, you will not only see Joshu face to face, but you will also go hand in hand with the successive founders, entangling your eyebrows with theirs, seeing with the same eyes, hearing with the same ears. Isn't that a delightful prospect? Wouldn't you like to pass this barrier? Arouse your entire body with its 360 bones and joints and its 84,000 pores of the skin. Summon up a spirit of great emptiness and concentrate on this word, Mu. Carry it continuously, day and night. Do not form a nihilistic concept of vacancy or a relative conception of has or has not. It will be just as if you swallowed a red-hot iron ball, which you cannot spit out even if you try. All the illusory ideas and delusive thoughts accumulated up to the present will be exterminated, and when the time comes, internal and external will be spontaneously united. You will know this, but only for yourself, like a dumb person, speechless person, who has had a dream. Then all of a sudden an explosive convulsion will occur and you will astonish the heavens and shake the earth. It will be as if you snatch away the great sword of the valiant general Kan U and hold it in your hand. When you meet the Buddha, you kill him. When you meet the patriarchs, the founders, you kill them. On the brink of life and death, you command perfect freedom. Among the sixfold worlds and four modes of existence, you enjoy a merry and playful samadhi. Now I want to ask you again, how will you carry it out? Employ every ounce of your energy to work on this Mu. If you hold on without interruption, behold, a single spark and the holy candle is lit. Mumon's verse, the dog, the Buddha nature, the pronouncement, perfect and final. Before you say it has and has not, you are a dead man on the spot. This is the final day of our August Sesshin. Several times during the early days of the Sesshin, I made mistakes. I said, the night everybody arrived here, I said, this is the April Sesshin. And later, I think the next day or the day after, I said, this is the autumn Sesshin. And indeed, it could be April and it could be autumn, you know. This weather is very strange. Usually we have incredibly hot weather, People here know from experience that the August Sesshin is legendary. It's usually so hot, it's like 100 degrees. We've had Sesshin where it's been, you know, just very, very hot. And so this is quite a delicious weather for sitting. On the other hand, we've had 4 days of rain and no sun in sight. And some people find that a little bit difficult to take. You can get cabin fever, you know. So if that's how you feel, whatever you do, don't go to live in Seattle. Okay? Because it's like this for about 9 months a year, right? And if you are there, it can really bother you. You know, I would come home sometime, and my wife would be crying, and I'd say, "What's wrong?" And she'd say, "I can't." She's from New Mexico, see, so where they get 320 days of sun every year. And I'd say, "What's wrong?" She, "Oh, I can't take this anymore. There's no sun." But I think, you know, you can find your own sun, you know, and then you have a different relationship to the weather, you know. It can be sunny or not. You know, if you can find your own light, you have a different relationship to events, and I think that's the best way to, for me personally, that's the best way to live. So, you know, if you're in this kind of weather and you're sitting very, very deeply, I think it can help you enormously. You know, this sort of makes people, takes away a lot of distractions, and it makes people sort of go deep into themselves. So not everybody's comfortable with that, but, you know, please keep going. So I think this has been a very successful sesshin. A number of people have come in to see me, and Indoka-san, and have told me about wonderful experiences they've had. One person came here with, very distracted mind, lot of thoughts on the plate, and many burdens, you know, klish, troubles. Troubles. And, you know, basically, day one, it's just, I see the troubles even more, you know. Day two, well, I don't know. Day three, feeling a little better. Day four, you know, like paradise, right? You just being in the moment, very few thoughts. And it's very restorative. To be able to achieve that condition. This is, sesshin can be a little bit like a karma hospital. You know, originally in the Asian world, this practice was only for monks and nuns. So, you know, basically you were a lay person or you did this as a monk or a nun, and that was that. But one of the wonderful things that's happening in this tradition in the 21st century is that, you know, it's available to people who have all kinds of busy lives. And so, you know, we have business people here, we have scientists, we have computer programmers and designers, we have journalists, we have artists. All kinds of people. It's remarkable. Students. And, you know, people who have all of these, all of these burdens and all of these problems and frustrations and obstacles can come here and work on the cushion, work through their obstacles and really have an experience of deep connectedness with life, you know. The boundary between yourself and the world drops away, and you can experience this profound sense of connectedness to things. It's really beautiful, right? Beautiful experience. And And that happens to almost everybody, to everybody, basically. If you sit long enough, you begin to have these experiences. And our word for those experiences is that sense of, it's where the sense of separation from the world drops away, and we begin to encounter oneness. That could be called prajna, wisdom, and that's the beginning of wisdom. Right? So when you're sitting on the cushion and you're in the groove and you're working through your obstacles, you are working towards a samadhi, one-pointed mind. And when your mind becomes very, very focused, you're in deep samadhi, you might feel like your hands or your face are disappearing, or you're floating, or your body is twisted around even though it's not. And then, so that's like deep samadhi, that everything disappears except for your hands or your face, or you're floating, or you're expanding. And then if you stay in that state long enough, you begin to have experiences of prajna, of a non-dualistic awareness. You know. And in those early states of prajna, those early states of non-dualistic awareness, you feel like you've gone to heaven. It's just like heaven. You know. It's a beautiful experience. You might want to just spend your life there. You might think, I'd love to just spend my life in this state. It is possible to make that condition of being your target. And, each time you come to Sesshin, work through your obstacles, and if you practice and you're lucky, you may get back to that beautiful state. And you could live your life like that. Yeah? And there would be nothing wrong with that. That's beautiful. So, some people practice Zen that way. They come to the karma hospital and they come in and it's an emergency case, and a high fever and strange symptoms, right? And sit on the cushion and treatment's the same for all the patients, so it's easy. make the same diagnosis, more zazen, it's easy to diagnose. Basically, everybody gets better, it's very effective. And, they've done all kinds of scientific studies on this too. They wire up people's brains and your brain waves really do behave differently after a while, and even endocrine function and things like this change. So, it's a very effective practice. And, if you like that oceanic experience, so to speak, that feeling of being connected to the universe, then that's, I love it too. It's why I practice, however, there are some complications that you should be aware of, people usually get to the lower stages of prajna, or sometimes we also just call that samadhi, deep samadhi. They get to those lower stages by, say, working with the breath perception koan. And the breath perception is really a koan, it's a focal point for meditation. And you're working with the breath perception koan, and you eventually can enter samadhi, very focused concentration, and then you can have your experience of prajna, non-dualistic awareness. And that's a beautiful condition, and it's wonderful. Now, in ancient India, many people said that that stage of prajna, of connection with the universe, was it. That was it. That's the highest state. There were many meditators in the Buddha's time who said, this is the highest state of awareness. What more could you ask for than this unity? Many schools of modern Hinduism actually teach that this, they call it samadhi, as a matter of fact. This state of samadhi, which we would call like a preliminary state of prajna, they would say, this is it. This is what it's all about, you know. And they would say, this is unity with God. Right? This is, now you've unified yourself with the totality. And I think this experience is quite wonderful. So if you say unity with God, that's fine with me. I would say unity with the world, or unity with everything. But interestingly enough, the Buddha wasn't satisfied with that experience. He said, well, you know, the funny thing is, you know, when I sit on the cushion and I enter, I have this beautiful experience where I'm sitting on the cushion and I have this wonderful feeling of connectedness. And as I'm walking out of the zendo, I see a little flower on the ground. And I look at the flower and I become the flower. See? This happened to me in the afternoon sit. It was a sunny day. It was August, you know, blah, blah, blah. See? So the next time I come to Sesshin, I think, oh boy, I can't wait for the bliss, right? So you sit on the cushion and you do everything the same way, right? You eat the same amount in each of your bowls, not too much, not too little. You get the same amount of sleep, do everything. Okay, day three was when you had your prajna experience. So you're waiting. Here it is, day three. Bring on the bliss, you know, right? So you sit on the cushion and think, I think I'm feeling it. I think it's a little, yeah, I can kind of feel it. I can kind of get it. I'm kind of a little, it's a little light, a little bright, yeah. So the bell rings and you go out and you see a flower and you say, oh, there's a flower again, just like last time, all right? And you lean down and you think, come on, baby, you know. Okay. Somehow it doesn't happen, right? It doesn't happen. And this is very interesting, right? I mean, this is really interesting because, you know, it happened once, but it doesn't happen again. And this happens to everybody who practices. Sooner or later, you begin to have these experiences where you feel this deep sense of connection. And you become very attached to that sense of connection. And you want to relive it, and it becomes like a little shrine in your head, right? And you remember the beautiful sesshin where you had this beautiful experience, and you want to repeat it again and again, because it's heavenly, right? It's beautiful. But you know, trying to repeat it is a very false thing to do. It's very false. It doesn't work, right? It doesn't work, and much of organized religion is based upon trying to make it work. You know, so you might go through a religious ceremony, and it might work. A lot of time they don't work at all. You know, they don't work. You go to mass, and you take the wafer, and it's just a, you know. It's just wheat in your mouth. You know, it's nothing. Maybe somebody goes and feels changed, transformed. Or you go through a Seder, and it's a different kind of thing. You know, different. You have a wonderful experience once, but it may not be the same next time. You know, see, and that's a problem, because we want to enshrine these experiences in some permanent form. And yet, you know. The meaning often drains away from them, you know. And this is something the Buddha noticed. So he said, really, if you cling to these kinds of experiences and insights, and even insights, even like ideas, you're creating a barrier. You make it harder for it to happen again, not easier. So he said, let's not stop here. there might be something beyond this experience, you know? And the fact that the beautiful vision disappears into nothingness is very significant, in my opinion. And it, I think it was in his too, although I don't want to put words in his mouth. You know, when I was a kid, when I was 12, I saw Billy Graham on TV. Some of you don't even know who Billy Graham is. But Billy Graham was this very galvanizing minister on the TV. He would have these huge like revival meetings in stadiums, and like 10,000 people would come and hear him preach. And he was the first television minister, first televangelist. And he would give, he was a great speaker. He had this galvanizing self-confidence, you know, and a very, very authentic manner. And he was incredibly powerful speaker. And at the end, you know, he'd say, come up and accept the Lord. And these people would just come down. It was a very powerful ceremony. So I remember watching that and just being blown away. So I decided to read the Bible, you know, when I was about 12. And it was incredibly hard to understand, you know, because it was like the King James Version of the Bible. And, you know, and it was full of weird things. First of all, that the language was weird, you know, because it's 17th century English. But also, the events are so weird, you know. And the things that happen, you know, people get turned into pillars of salt and stuff like that. It's like, huh? You know, pillar of salt? What is a pillar, anyway? What would a pillar of salt be? You know, and this kind of stuff, you know. And full of weird stuff, you know, weird things. You know, and he cleft the rock and things like, huh? What's a cleft, you know? Heard of a cleft palate, you know, so it was hard to wade through this, you know. But I sort of got the feeling for it, you know. And I spent like a summer reading the Bible, and I really got into it, you know. I really got into it. This really was true. And for the summer, I was like living in Bible land, you know what I mean? I was just like in the Bible land. And you can be in Buddha land, same way. You know, you can read the sutras, you can read Tricycle magazine and so on. You can be in Buddha land, you know. And you can have Buddhas on your wall and all this stuff. And for a summer I was like in Bible land, you know. But I just couldn't sustain it. You know, I just couldn't sustain it. After a while it was just too difficult to sustain this feeling. You know, I'd get this feeling, you know, sort of like I was onto something, you know, like I was in the presence of something. But I couldn't make it last, you know. And then I got into science fiction, and then, you know, I started reading novels, and that was the end, you know. Until I started doing Zen, that was sort of the end of my religious life, if you want to. I couldn't make it last, you know. And I think this is a problem for believers, no matter what, whether it's religious belief or not, you know. I think believers have a hard time because, you know, you get into something and it's very engaging and exciting. And it seems to explain everything, right, you know. And it can have, like the Bible has great poetry, or the Quran. If you've ever read the Quran, the poetry in the Quran is just like astounding, you know, it's so good. And it's so compelling, you know. And you can have this powerful emotional response, but it starts to fade. And then that creates like a crisis of, all religions have this crisis of faith, right? Crisis of faith. And this is like an enormously problematic problem for like a belief, any belief system. Like the crisis of faith, where I feel like, you know, I've read this book, I accept it as true, but somehow I can't keep it up. And I feel this doubt creeping in all the time. You know, billions of people are troubled in this way. And it's like, I feel these doubts, you know, and I want, you know, you want to tuck it away somewhere. It's like, my God, I put everything, I've got everything riding on my beliefs, you know, and now they're part of my own self is not convinced, you know. And so a lot of religion is based upon like constantly stoking the fires of belief. You know, don't listen to those doubts, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is that, you know, beliefs fade away. They disappear into nothingness. Looks like experiences disappear into nothingness. This is very interesting. You know, I work in an English department, and there's secular beliefs too. You know, there's beliefs that that aren't religious, but people embrace them in the same way. So when I was going to graduate school, there was a philosopher, a French philosopher. Is there any other kind of philosopher? No. There's actually a German philosopher. There's German philosophers and French philosophers, and there's an occasional Italian philosopher, but mostly they're German and French. And basically, this French philosopher wrote these books, and I was like, oh! His name was Derrida. Everybody read Derrida. It was like if you went into an English department, it had become the department of Derrida. Right? And it was like Derrida was like the religion of the English department. And people read these books, which were hard to understand, and it was just like reading scripture. You know, you read these books, and it seemed so compelling. You know, it was so compelling. And people would get into like dogmatic arguments. That's not what Derrida means. No, you're totally wrong. You know, and he's an idiot. He doesn't understand Derrida. You know, it's an argument. And I alone understand the real Derrida. You know, and then Derrida made it all the more complicated because he kept changing his position. You know, so his true believers would say, "This is the real Derrida," and Derrida would go, "No, that's not really what I meant." You know, and so you know, after 25 years of this. It all just started to die away. It was like the energy went out of these ideas, and it's so terrifying for people when this happens. You know, it's like a crisis of faith, right? You know, so all these people, you know, 25 years is a professional life. So if you're a graduate student, and you usually graduate around 30. You start reading Derrida in graduate school. So that's 5 years of reading Derrida, and then you know his ideas are influential for about 20 years. That's pretty much you're now 50 when he starts dying, when his ideas start dying, right? And you're stuck because you're kind of old at 50. I mean, I'm 55, 54. So it's not as old as I used to think it was, right? But at 55, you're not necessarily ready to retool and learn all these new skills, you know. So basically, a lot of people are just sort of like unhappy because Derrida is like the belief system that failed or that died, see. And so they've invested all of this energy into this. So this is very interesting. I hope I'm not sounding too philosophical, but when we try to hold on to anything, any idea or any experience, it just fades away. You can, you know, this summer I celebrated my 30th anniversary with my wife, and we went to Hawaii, which is something we never did. And it was a great experience. You know, we could say in 5 years, hey, let's go back to Hawaii. Let's do it again, you know. And we could book the same rooms, you know. I'll bet you $1 million, you know, that it won't be the same experience. And we could get back there and go, do you feel it? Do you feel the wonder? You know, but it's not coming back. It's not, you know, because you can't go to the beach the second time and have the same experience. You know, you can't stay in those little sharecropper's huts and go, oh, this is so cool, we're really back to the earth and all this stuff, second time. Second time you're straining to recapture the experience. So, you know, when these things happen, when everything dies or just, disappears, when all the meaning drains out of life, you know, it's a real predicament. And it's terrifying for people, right? It's truly frightening. But maybe this happens because it has something to do with the nature of reality. See, maybe our ideas are not not real. They're kind of arbitrary, you know? And so we create these structures of meaning, but they can't last because reality is always changing, yeah? And then we have this crisis as our beliefs no longer give us the rush or the, yeah? I hope I'm making some sense. So you have crisis of faith, right? So interestingly, the Buddha said, yes, this has to happen. And that experience of like doubt, of doubt, of not knowing, is very, very, very important. And instead of hiding it away and tucking it away and going, uh-oh, this is terrible, how can I recover my belief? We actually say, let's try being in a state of not knowing, of not believing. You know, really, it's not so, you know, many people think the worst thing in the world is to have no beliefs or have no fixed beliefs. You'll meet a lot of people who will say, I've got to believe in something. You know, I'm just looking, I've got to believe in something. See? But you know, there's a kind of desperation, I think, about that, in my opinion. And you know, once you find the thing you believe in, most of the rest of your life is spent trying to protect it from threats. You know, so this is a little different way of life, in my opinion. You know, I think that this is a Zen is really about not being terrified when all your beliefs, you know, disappear, or when you come to Sesshin. And you say, okay, I'm ready for the bliss. It's day three. I'm supposed to sit on the cushion, enter deep samadhi, have a prajna experience, go outside and see the flower, experience one. None of those things happen, right? And the natural or the human reaction is to say, oh my God, you know, oh my God, this can't be happening. You know, I came to Sesshin, it was the thing I was counting on, right? I was counting on this to get me out of hell, and now I'm going to be back in hell, right? And this is a terrifying moment, right? Because we think that God has failed us, right? Our God has failed us, right? And now we think, where can I find a new God, a new set of beliefs that will work? Or it could be a new Derrida. See, Derrida has failed us. There must be a philosopher out there who's closer to the truth. It's like, ha ha ha, not a chance. It's just another house of cards, see? And some houses of cards are useful, right? You need some beliefs to get things done. So, you know, basically, you need some beliefs to get things done. That's just absolutely true. But reality has a way of not conforming to your beliefs. You know, one of the things that I thought was so interesting about, you know, I lived a lot of my life in Seattle. The western part of the state is constantly raining. It's like this, and there's a big mountain range in the middle of the state, the Cascade Mountains, and on the other side it's the desert. And there used to be a rich rainforest over there, but over the millions of years, the mountains grew so high, they cut off the clouds. And all those trees died away, and you have a desert with lots of petrified forest, you know. And it's very dry over there. And in the 1920s and 30s, there were all these people over there who were desperately poor. Desperately poor. And they had a hand-to-mouth existence, and there was a president in the United States named Roosevelt. And Roosevelt, he believed very much in helping the down and out. And I do too. I think it's very important, you know. So he went to Eastern Washington and he built a great dam there. And the dam generates all this electric power, and it makes it's a socialist triumph, you know. I mean, I'm not trying to preach to a particular political, but if you're a socialist, it shows socialism can work, because the government spent millions and millions of dollars on this great dam, the Columbia River Dam, and it turned a desert, a poverty-stricken desert, into a very prosperous region. And so all of those people who were so downtrodden were lifted out of poverty, and of course the first thing they did was to vote the Democrats out of office. You know, interesting, huh? And they're hardcore Republicans, and they hate the government, you know. So you go figure. You know? Very interesting. So our plans don't always work out. When our plans fall apart, we might feel like this is a crisis. Right? This is a crisis. But you know, it might be possible to, you know, if you stay in the darkness of not knowing long enough, you might realize that beliefs are not so important, that they're not not so important, that you can live without beliefs. It can be done. You know, it seems impossible. You can live without beliefs. And basically, it can't be done all at once. It can't be done easily. But, you know, when you dwell in emptiness, when you dwell in mushin, you find that strangest thing is that when you have no beliefs, instead of life becoming, life becomes meaningless. But you know what? When life is meaningless, that doesn't mean it doesn't have, when life is meaningless, it doesn't mean you can't connect with it. And when you connect with it, you find you have, you know, love, compassion, energy, joy. See, all in the absence of meaning. Isn't that interesting? Love, compassion. You know, we think what we want is meaning. We want a philosophy that explains things. And if you want that, no problem. But I've never seen a philosophy that doesn't die on the vine, you know. My humble opinion is, the more we cling to beliefs, the more threadbare they become. And so everybody finds themselves in this terrible crisis over and over again. You're either clinging to your beliefs and pretending nothing's wrong, or you're desperately searching for beliefs. But it's not easy. Because, you know, we do want beliefs, but when you get into that empty state, you might be in a position to say, look, what I thought I wanted was meaning, but what I really want is connection. See, I thought I wanted meaning, but what I really want is connection. And connection is, you know, meaning doesn't necessarily make us connected. So look, I might go to my office and meet somebody who's, I have people I work with who are, belong to a different religious tradition, you know. One of the people in my office is an Orthodox Jew. Another person who works in the writing program is a minister, is a Church of Christ minister. Now, you know, It would be, you know, if beliefs, we don't believe the same thing, but we can enjoy, we can connect, see? We can connect. And I think the connections are the connections are where it's at, you know? The connections are so important. You know, I my wife doesn't have my beliefs, and I have a deep, enduring love for my wife. Now, beliefs are just not, I don't think they're as important as connections, you know? So anyway, you know, don't be panicky if you're sitting on your cushion and you're calling moo and you feel like you're in a big hole, big dark hole, you know? And you can say, oh my God, you know, I've been waiting for bliss and now I'm stuck in this big black place. You know, this is horrible, you know. I want the bliss, bring back my bliss, you know. I want that flower, I want that afternoon in August, etc. You know, if you stay there long enough, you're going to be transformed. You're going to have connection. It's not going to take the form you experienced in the past, and it never will. It never will. See, a person came in to see me in Dokusan. In fact, people say this all the time, right? A person came in to see me and said, you know, I've been doing this Zen practice for 6 years. You would think it would get easier. Now, every time you give me a koan, I feel like I'm right back in the same damn place, right? And I thought, oh, thank God, you know, exactly. You know, you're always back, starting from zero. You're always starting from zero. This is called beginner's mind. Everybody buys that book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and they read it and think, oh, this is so wonderful. But when they get there, it's not necessarily so good at first, right? You're in beginner's mind and you're thinking, oh, crap, you know, I've been doing this for 6 years, you'd think it would help. You think my past experience with koans would help? It's like I'm right back in the same uncertainty. I think that's what it means to be deeply alive. I mean, personally, I think that's what it means to be deeply alive. You know, yesterday was yesterday. This moment is this moment. You know, somebody, I don't think this person would mind my saying this, came into Dokusan and said, you know, I had had this blissful experience at my last session. I had another experience, but it was quite unlike that. It was just like 25 minutes went by and they were complete, it was just empty. There was just nothing, it was just like there was nothing there. And the person said, it's hard to describe, but there was no, you know, in my previous sit, I'd had this joy, I'd had this connection. Well, this was like just emptiness. And I said, you know, that's such a great achievement. You know, this is a higher level of experience, at least in my way of thinking. You know, there's a saying there are some Hindu people who actually still revere the Buddha. And they said, I heard one Hindu person say that, you know, basically this person said it's like this. For humans, looking up into the heavens, there are gods in the heavens. But when you go up through the heavens and you go to the highest level of enlightenment, you look down and you see there are no gods. There's just the earth. Or another way to put it is the earth is, you know, this world is God. You know. So in a higher, you know, clinging to bliss is not necessarily the highest way, right? That there's a higher, you know, when we recite the Heart Sutra, we say, somebody asked the Bodhisattva, how do I achieve liberation? And the person says, the path to liberation is no form, no eye, no ear, no thought of self, no self, and no freedom from self. Yet no sickness, no freedom from sickness, and so on and so on. It's beyond form, beyond form. Now, you know, this experience of the beyond form is, you know, our ideas crumble into nothingness because nothingness is there all the time, haunting us, like a shadow, right? And people run from it. But if you don't run from it, if you stay with it, it's like everything springs to life. It's like everything springs to life. This is like the sword that kills and gives life. It's like everything springs to life. You know, this is so alien to Western thinking. Ancient Chinese people understood this. If you read Lao Tzu or early Chinese poets, that everybody knew this. that the universe springs out of emptiness. The universe is constantly arising from emptiness, changing and disappearing back into emptiness. This is like ancient Chinese belief. Everybody knew this in East Asia. The word for this is everything, I'm not going to pronounce it right, but Zuchan, Zujan, Zujan. I'm not pronouncing it, but I won't anymore. I mean, you could say, literally it's self-so, or self-creating. Everything arises out of nothingness, beautiful form emerges, and then back into nothingness. This goes on and on. This is life. This is the yin and yang, of life. So this is one of the reasons that Buddhism took such deep root in China, because people said, of course, what else is new? But for us, very alien, because we think of emptiness, and we think of that as like a crisis. Oh my God, my beliefs are gone, now what? See, and it's like, when your beliefs are gone, have you heard the rain? When your beliefs are gone, have you tasted the rice? When your beliefs are gone, have you ever taken a pee-pee without your beliefs? Beautiful, beautiful, right? It's like heaven itself. Yeah. So, anyway, don't be afraid of mu. Don't be afraid of emptiness, and don't cling to bliss, please. Very important, and this also, I'll wrap it up soon, but the thing is, we assent to this. Maybe we'll say, okay, fair enough, I get it. But, on a deeper level, we still have this habit, not trusting emptiness. We experience the emptiness, but it takes a long time to trust it. To really, really be able to, when people sit in, after people start doing Zen practice, you begin to enter that blank mind, and for a long time people think, oh, what's that all about? Nothing's happening, And then you can say, look, try to find the answer in the blank mind. And that's very hard for people to trust that, when you give people koans, they try to reason their way through them. And it's like, all right, I trust blank mind, but let me see if I can figure this out, And it's like back to trying to find a belief or a philosophy, right, But eventually people realize there's really no way to explain the universe. Any explanation is just like a partial, flawed, bound to be replaced, etc. So after a while you say, okay, I can't figure this koan out, I can't. So maybe I'll just sit here in blankness and see what happens, and eventually something happens. It's really astounding. But everything comes out of that beautiful blankness. Everything. So anyway, I've probably said too much, actually. Sometimes it's better for people just to work it out on their own. In fact, that's what people have to do anyway. But I'm supposed to give a teisho, so there you go. By the way, there's a little poem at the start of Mu Mong's preface, at the start of the Mu Mong Khan. The U Mu Mong Khan, Mu means nothing, no. Mong means gate, so U men, and Khan or Kwan is barrier. So Mu Mong Khan literally means nothingness, gate, barrier. See? There's a gate of nothingness is the barrier. Right? So in other words, people are afraid of nothingness, but don't be. It's not a barrier, it's a door. Door. Okay. And there's a little poem, it goes like this. The great way is gateless, approached in a thousand ways. There's a thousand paths to enlightenment. See? Once past this checkpoint, you stride through the universe. Right? If you're not afraid of nothingness, what can bother you? Then it's just the everything brings life. You're not afraid. Those moments when we, you know, it's like those moments of emptiness, those moments of nothingness are so frightening, you know. But when you sit there long enough, it's like life springs out of every pore of your body, and everything becomes your home. You know, that's how it is. You know? Beautiful. A monk asked Joshu, "Has a dog the Buddha nature?" Joshu answered, "Mu." The dog, the Buddha nature, the pronouncement, perfect and final. Whether you say it has Buddha nature or has not, you are emptiness on the spot. Yeah?